Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for Wealth DNA with Ron the Ronald Naraki. It's time to check your Wealth DNA so you can enjoy the second half of life. Here's the host of the show, Ron Naraki.
Hello, and welcome to the Wealth DNA radio show. I'm honored that you're joining us today, and whether you own a house or are interested in investing in real estate, I'm confident you'll be very glad you tuned in today. And hopefully will join us every 2 weeks for the Wealth DNA radio show. When will housing prices rise? Today we'll be talking with a guy that knows more about the Phoenix housing market than anyone else on the planet. And that's our topic today. When will housing prices rise? For those of you that live in other parts of the U.S. or other parts of the world, I can assure you the information you learn today will help you predict what will be happening in other markets. Our guest today is Michael Orr, who has been our guest in the past on this Wealth DNA radio show in April, yes, 1 year ago, April of 2011. Now, in normal times, not much changes in just 1 year, especially when we're talking about housing, which is a long-term investment. Although I'm sure everyone listening realizes that since 2002, these are not normal times for the housing market. Now, Michael Orr, let me tell you a little bit about him. He holds a master's degree in mathematics from the University of Oxford, and when he comes on, you will hear a slight accent for the Americans that are used to an American accent. So, Oxford University in England. He then spent 31 years in the computer industry, working for IBM, Amdahl, Splash Technology, and the Santa Cruz operation. And none of those sound like real estate, do they? Well, let me keep going. Since 2002, he decided enough of that computer stuff. He's focused on real estate in Arizona. And as I mentioned, 2002 seemed to be the end of the normal times for the housing market in Arizona and the rest of the country. For that matter, it's affected the entire world. Michael founded the Crawford Report in 2008, which certainly has become the source for information on the Phoenix real estate market since then. And by the way, I am confident when I look around at the data available in other markets and other parts of the world, there is no better source for data than we have right here in Phoenix. Now, in addition to running the Crawford Report, he was recently appointed the director of the Real Estate Center at the W.P. Carey School of Business at Arizona State University, we affectionately call ASU. Now, when Michael was on this show in April of 2011, he gave us a well-supported prediction of when housing prices would bottom. And the question is, was he right? Was he too optimistic or too pessimistic? That's one of the 20 or more topics I hope to cover today with his help. Today is Monday, April 23rd, 2012. It's 8:03. My eyesight here. 8:03 in Arizona. And obviously other time zones are going to be off by a number of hours. You're tuned into the Wealth DNA radio show. I'm your host, Ron Naraki, and look forward to you joining us every second and fourth Monday. Money is our topic, but Monday is what it is, Mondays. Now, even though there was an important round of elections in France this weekend, I'd prefer to get right to our topic of the day, which, by the way, is likely to have a far bigger impact on your portfolio and my portfolio than that election. The topic, when will housing prices rise? Let's give a warm radio welcome to Michael Orr. Welcome, Michael.
Good morning. Thanks very much for having me on the show.
Well, I'm really glad you found the time to join us this morning and share some insights on residential real estate, and always look forward to talking to you and getting some information and learn more about the market. So thank you for being with us.
You're very welcome.
In 2008, you started the Cromford Report. It seems like much longer, because by 2008, when I was actively involved in this market, it seemed to be around forever.
Forever.
I just arrived here. But it pretty quickly became the gold standard for housing market information in the Phoenix area. Since many of our listeners are also entrepreneurs, share some of the factors that help you become so successful so quickly. I mean, here we are in less than 4 years. It really is a premier data source. So what were some of those factors that made you so successful?
Well, I think the first thing was spotting a hole in the market, you know, a niche that I could occupy. There's plenty of people doing data analysis, but they tend to focus on either the commercial market or on new homes. And I felt that the resale home market was really quite neglected. Although there were sources, they were rather slow to report, and the data was a bit suspect. I thought there was an opportunity. And I guess what I did was make a list of all the things I could do differently to make the Cromford Report stand out. And one of them was reporting every day. Most people only report every month, so I guess I'm appealing to the people who are really obsessed with the housing market because they want information every day. And by that time, I'd got quite obsessed because the market was obviously being extremely interesting from about 2003 onwards. And the second thing I did was put an enormous amount of effort into cleaning and scrubbing the data sources, because in real estate, most of the data is entered into systems without being double-checked, and it needs an awful lot of cleaning to be able to derive important and useful information from it. I do that every day, and it's not very visible, but when people realize that was going on, it gave me a lot more credibility, because I was putting a huge amount of effort into making sure it was right before I published it.
Now, are you implying that realtors sometimes don't really care about paperwork and filling out all the details?
Oh, I think they care. It's just not. No, you know, you and I, too, we never forget entering data. We don't do it correctly all the time. And, if in most other businesses, there's kind of a cross-check, you know, there's a balance at the bottom of the books that makes sure if you're a penny out in banking that you go and resolve it. And, you know, Wall Street doesn't tolerate things that don't add up quite right. But in real estate, you know, you can transpose the numbers of the parcel number and nobody will notice. And that, not just for the MLS, that's for the public records too. The number of errors in public records for deeds is why we need title insurance, you know.
Exactly.
There's all sorts of mistakes.
And I'm closing on a transaction today that has the wrong address in the public records.
Right. So What I decided to do was combine the MLS records and the public records, and by comparing them, I can spot a lot of the errors, because if they're different, I know one of them's wrong. I don't necessarily know which one's wrong, but it allows me to go in and fix things. And then I guess the other thing I did is I tried to let the data tell me what was going on. I wasn't trying to start from a preconceived economic theory and make the data fit that. I was basically saying, well, every morning, and let's see what's happening. Is supply going up or down? Is sales going up or down? And if it was different from what I expected, I didn't regard that as a negative thing. I thought it was interesting and exciting. So, the other theory that I did have in the back of my mind is that real estate was actually fairly predictable compared with the stock market, because transactions take a very long time to happen. So there's plenty of warning when something changes. People agree on a price, they go into escrow, and it's often a month or two later before the price actually gets recorded. So if you're looking at information from things that are in escrow and new listings coming on, you get good warning that there's a change going on in the market, and therefore you can more accurately call the bottom and the top of a market than you can in, say, the stock market. At least that's my theory.
No, I think you think you're absolutely right. Now, it's been just about as wild recently, but that doesn't negate what you just said. Okay, but looking back now, you've got a little bit of hindsight since you started this thing. Are there any things you would do differently? Obviously, your partnership with MLS has really been important. So tell us, are there any things you would do differently as a business person starting that business?
Well, I've had a load of fun, and I've had a tremendous amount of help. So most things I would do the same. Certainly the support from Armless in making the product well-known, Also support from Alan Langston of Azria in the early days. That got me better known for the investors in the Phoenix market. And also partnering with the Information Market, who are one of the people who helps grab the public records. So they, we've been working together for 4 years now, and they've been extremely helpful to me. And I feed a lot of information back to them, too. And I guess the other people who have been most helpful is just those enthusiasts who latched onto it, because I haven't done very much marketing. It's really been a word-of-mouth thing. And people have just told each other about it, and the usage has grown through that. So the only thing I would really change, I think, would be the tools that I use. I was really focused on getting the end result, so I didn't always use the most efficient tools. I wasn't too worried about how long it took to get the result, as long as the result was right. And over time, I started with desktop tools like Excel and Access, and over time I've realized I should have started with more, you know, corporate-level tools, bigger machines, and I use SQL Server now for the database because Access can't cope with the volumes I'm dealing with, and it's much more efficient working those tools than the ones I was using in the early days.
Yeah, but you don't know how successful you're going to be, and it's always you can't put too much money in at the very beginning until you're sure that it's all going to grow and work.
Yeah, the bigger tools are more expensive.
Yep, no doubt about it. No doubt about it. Now, since a lot of our listeners have access to the internet while they're listening, share the website name so they can take a look at it and at least get a feel for what we're talking about if they haven't seen it before.
It's CromfordReport.com, C-R-F-O-R-D, report.com. And,
correct. I don't want them starting to look for MichaelOr.com or something like that. So.
No. If you Google Cromford, find out about the town of Cromford in England or the Cromford Report.
Gotcha. And that's where I never asked you where the name came from. Yeah. So Cromford Report, C-R-O-M-F-O-R-D Report.
Yeah, I used to live on Cromford Road close to in Derbyshire in England before I moved to the U.S.
How about that? Okay. I was always wondering where that name came from. I mean, it's obviously a good name. It just obviously it just doesn't correlate with your name, and that's why I was curious. Okay. What options are there for subscribers? Somebody decides they like everything they hear on this upcoming show, and we got so much to cover. They decide they want to subscribe. I don't want to wait to the end and forget to say this. How, you know, what options are there? Do they have to subscribe on an annual basis? And you know, gave us a range of fees.
Well, you can subscribe monthly, quarterly, or annually. It's cheapest if you sign up for the full year. You do have to have an Armless ID because the data that I use from Armless is proprietary, and the restriction in the data license is that I have to check that you're an active member of Armless at the time. Mm-hmm. But if you are, and there's probably some 30,000 or so people who are, then you can sign up $35 a month for the monthly, $30 a month if you sign up for 3 months, and $25 a month for the annual subscription.
I guess I never noticed that correlation of the $5 down per month. Okay. You know, look at the total amount. I didn't look at that. Okay.
That's
appeals
very
to logical.
Mathematicians like me, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Keeping it simple is always a good idea. Now, I assume the vast majority, and I think you just confirmed, are either realtors, appraisers, or, as I call them, housing providers. Others might call them real estate investors. I assume that's the biggest part of your subscriber base.
Yes, certainly. Vast majority are realtors, a few appraisers, and investors who have a license and an Armless ID, of which many do. There's obviously lots of interest from people in mortgage banking and title companies too, and often people who are working in that industry also have licenses. So it runs a little bit wider than purely realtors and brokers, but they're probably more than 90% of the people who subscribe.
Okay. Now, in 2012, a big change. I was quite surprised very beginning of the year when I heard the news. You took on an additional role at ASU that I mentioned. I see you quote it more often than even before, and I even see more interviews on television. I even saw you on CNN, not to drop names, but let's call it the cable news channels. Tell us a little bit about that new role.
Well, I'm a research professional for ASU, and my role is to establish a new structure for monitoring and reporting on the real estate market, really expanding on the ideas that are used in the Cromford Report, but bringing them to a wider audience, and gradually expanding it beyond just residential housing into and try and consolidate information from multiple sources and hopefully for a wider geographic area. Obviously, I won't be able to do that all on my own, but working with ASU, we've got some ambitious plans for putting an interactive site together that will be a resource for everybody who's interested in housing. And I'm very excited about working with the GIS experts to make it more map-based instead of just based on graphs and tables, so that we can obviously... real estate is about location, so presenting things in map form is an excellent opportunity.
Right, and I know, being at the ESRIA presentations, I know that you've already have access to some of the data that wasn't easily available before, so it looks
right.
Like you have some data sources at ASU that complement what you're doing for us. So that's nice to see. So as a subscriber, we kind of get to see more and more over time.
Right.
And get a little bit broader and deeper information, and interesting that you'd actually be moving into, if you will, brought into the commercial market as well, which again, there's no such database that I've found anywhere that covers
it. Well, I mean, obviously a lot of people work in the commercial field. They tend to keep proprietary sets of information, and
right.
I'm not going to be moving into that in the very near future. That's something
which is
more of a long-term goal, but to try and basically allow people to collaborate and share information that they're willing to share and make it available for the public good for people like city planners and developers so that they can make better decisions.
Yeah, very, very interesting. I'll look forward to that. I'm sure you're busier than you were before, but what can you do? That, things move forward. You just got
to
find ways to be more efficient, right?
Right.
Now, I want to avoid confusing our listeners and jumping around from topic to topic. So what I wanted to do is subdivide our discussion in a little bit, first of all, very briefly, where we've been as far as the housing market is, and most people know roughly, but they don't necessarily know the numbers, then where we are today. Thirdly, where we're going, and we'll talk a little bit about your prior prediction. And then finally, what I'd like to do is get some of the contrasts of what you see here in detail in the Phoenix market to what's happening in the broader U.S. housing market. Would that agenda work for you?
Sounds great.
I sure hope so. Okay, great. Let's start with where we've been. Now, I've looked through the historical data, obviously, numerous times, but I reviewed it again preparing for this show, and obviously using the Cromford Report, and it appears that Phoenix housing prices were very steadily increasing, 3 to 5%, up until about 2001. And if I use, I'm going to stick with one measure of housing prices, which is dollars per square foot. Prices were around $100 a square foot, almost exactly that amount at that time. Now, what changed in 2001, 2002 that all of a sudden that steady pace changed?
Well, I would say that we carried on fairly normally through 2001 and 2002, and it was really the spring of 2003 where things started to really look a little odd. There were far more people looking to buy homes in that spring than expected. All of the builders' sales offices suddenly got very busy. And I think the main cause was the availability of money. It started to become obvious that you could get a loan with a lower credit score, with lower documentation. You could borrow a higher percentage of the home value, up to 100% or even over 100% in some cases. And people started to enthusiastically buy homes, not just for themselves, but as a commodity to trade to other people. And that kind of fed on itself as the first people to try it were successful and made money and told other people about it. And we got the makings of a bubble going on by the time we were into 2004. Lots of people entering the market, borrowing other people's money to buy houses and not really even thinking about renting or them to people, just selling them a few months later to somebody else for a higher value. And everybody was saying, well, house prices have always gone up, even though that's not true, of course, and as we now know. But the theory then was that prices would only go up, so if you ever got into trouble, all you did was refinance and equity would be built for you, basically with somebody else making the majority of the initial stake. And obviously that was going to end in tears, and did. Once everybody had bought homes to the extent that we had far more supply than was needed, and suddenly everybody was trying to sell and nobody was interested in buying.
Yeah, just going back, I mean, I don't want to cover the whole root causes of that, you know, that liquidity, that availability of funds, because obviously it's, mm-hmm. it's pretty complex and actually rooted back in the 70s from the research I've done. But
right.
if we were to summarize what was going on at that point, the buying, the selling, the realtors, the mortgage brokers, the banks, everything else, can we use the word greed to say that was really kind of the root of what was going on?
Well, I think you can put a lot of it down to that. Everybody was making lots of money, and once they started making money, they wanted to make even more. So everybody in mortgage banking was getting paid for writing loans. Everybody working in sales, in title companies, all making more money than they ever had before. So everybody thought it was a good thing. But you know, mm-hmm. when you look back and say, well, we had 45% appreciation in a single year, it was clear that couldn't last forever. That had not been seen in history before. And it was going to come back to bite us. And unfortunately, it did.
It did. Now, you watched that market. You didn't have all of the tools you have today, but you were active in this market. What were some of the indications you saw in 5 and 6, because that was kind of the first
yeah.
that would be visible, that indicated this bubble wouldn't last forever, other than common sense?
I was measuring from 2004 initially for my own purposes, and one of the key things I was measuring was the number of active listings on the MLS. That gives you a good handle on supply. That had been diving quite fast from 2003 all the way to the end of March 2005, and in April, at the beginning of April, it turned around and headed in the opposite direction, more than a 90-degree turn. And so that suggested something was up. By the time we got to June, it was going up quite fast, and that's when I thought, okay, well, this is the end starting to happen. Most people were still crazily overbidding each other for homes for another 6 to 9 months after that, but the number of homes being listed for sale was going up each month, and we quickly headed past normal and to an excess during 2006. So personally, I took that as a sell signal. I had an investment home that I decided to list in August 2005 and sold pretty quickly because the market was still hot then. But prices still continued to go up until
Correct.
We got to the middle of 2006 when they kind of started looking a little bit shaky, held on really for another year, and it wasn't till the second half of 2007 that fear really overtook the greed, and prices started collapsing. And so they went down even faster than they'd gone up.
Absolutely.
Everybody
just
trying
to
get
the numbers.
Market.
Since I happen to have them in front of me, the housing prices in 2006 peaked, so using that same number of dollars per square foot, at 190. So in just 4 to 5 years, we saw 90% appreciation in prices,
right.
which compared to 3 to 5% a year is clearly abnormal. But you
right.
know what? I just realized when you said that, I guess this was your first indication that when you look at the detailed data and the real indicators, you're going to see things well ahead of time. As you saw the supply numbers and went ahead and sold your investment property, you could have hung on for another year and continue to make more money because you had data ahead of time. So it was
yeah.
a good lead indicator.
I decided that discretion was the better part of valor, and it was not ideal to hang on for the highest price because by then there aren't so many buyers and you could be left holding it. Best to sell, you know, not necessarily get the highest possible price, but make
right.
sure you liquidate. And I made a mistake, of course. I should have sold the house I was living in, too, not just investment properties, because if I'd sold that house and then rented for a few years, I'd have made a lot of savings. But I don't think my wife and children would have liked that idea so much.
No, that's correct. And also, if we made all the right decisions in our lives, none of us would be bothering to share information with others. We'd all be sitting
right.
in the Bahamas or someplace drinking Mai Tais.
Yes.
But I'm glad things worked the way they did. You learned a lot, and you're obviously going to help the rest of the market avoid these mistakes in the future. Now, I guess if we looked at the markets, the financial markets, and all the derivatives available there, if they were available in housing prices, you could have made a lot of money buying puts back in 2005 and 2006.
Yes, actually, I started studying the market because I wanted to invest. And then when I saw the figures saying, well, not a good time to be buying, I thought, well, how can I take some put options on this? And apart from shorting the stock of home builders, there really wasn't much of an effective way of doing that.
That's correct. That's correct. Now, that's probably just as well, because otherwise it might have been worse than it was. Okay, and as you touched on, then 2007 to 2009, that drop was even faster and even deeper. So we actually dropped more in 3 years than we saw that increase in 4 to 5 years. And looking at the data, well, let me, before I jump to the data, you know, how do you then, looking back, as you're developing, you've been tracking this data, you now launched the Cromford Report officially during that crash. Give us a few for what was going on from your point of view.
Well, by that time, a lot of the people who'd taken out loans to buy houses had stopped payments on them, mm-hmm. partly because they couldn't afford them, partly because they knew that they had negative equity and they weren't that interested in holding on to the property. So everybody who had a sort of tenuous hold and commitment to the property was starting to give it back to the bank, which, of mm-hmm. course, was making the situation worse as the market flooded with gluts of foreclosed homes. And prices were coming down at 5, 6% per month during that 2008 period. And the big question was, when was it ever going to stop? It looked like it was headed to zero. And I thought, well, this is pretty exciting because I will be able to tell when it's going to stop by looking at what's happening in the escrow probably a month before everybody else notices. So it was mm-hmm. actually February, March 2009 when I realized the price declines were starting to stop and about to turn around, and indeed did. By the time we got to April, it was slightly higher than March, and for the mm-hmm. next year or so, prices actually edged up each month instead of down. So we had a sort of very sharp reversal in the overall context. It didn't look like a permanent reversal, because after we saw the tax credit expire in 2010, we took another dip mm-hmm. down to the same level that we had reached in March 2009. But essentially, that was the first bottom in a W-shaped sort of bottoming cycle. And it was pretty exciting times because it brought a huge transaction rate in as investors started gobbling up as many houses as they could during 2009 to turn into rentals or to fix and flip.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really the investors who made that bottom happen, but I think without them coming in, we would have gone an awful lot lower in pricing.
Yeah, and just to share the numbers with our listeners, in April 2009, we were sitting just about $80 a square foot, and obviously that differed whether we're looking at monthly averages, daily, and all of that. But
right.
About $80 a square foot, and it hit me recently. I think I even mentioned to you in an email that I now can use that phrase "a lost decade" when it applies to housing prices, not just the financial markets, because
yeah.
from 2001 to 2009, we're down 20%.
Right.
In housing prices, despite that huge boom. So 20% down over a decade is just enormous.
In fact, it's now 12 years. We were
correct.
$100 a square foot, as you said, in 2000, and we're still below $100 a square foot today. So
that's correct. Absolutely. So, yeah, we hit about that 80, and then what? We went up for about a year, went down again, and well,
we went up
about
to 90 and then back down to 80 again for a long time during 2011. And at the time we last spoke, April 2011, we were back down around 82 again.
That is correct, and that's when I had you on the show, and we talked about where we're going. We'll get to that in just a minute. I don't want to
mm-hmm.
kind of jump ahead and tell too much. I have one more question for you on this kind of where we've been. Is the U.S. government launched this, and you touched on it, this home buyer credit in 2009, 2010 to help the market. In hindsight, was that the right thing to do?
Well, I'm not sure it had any lasting benefit. It gave away a lot of government money, and I have to say, at the time, both parties were fully in tune with it, so it wasn't really a partisan thing. Everybody seemed to think it was a great idea to get the housing market back on its feet. I think home builders appreciated because they were rescued from a really dire situation, but from the person's point of view of somebody buying a home then, they got a bit of a tax credit, but if they just waited 6 months, they would have probably have saved that amount of money because house prices came back down again once the tax credit expired. So it didn't really have any effect except pulling demand forward by several months and pushing it all into the spring of 2010. So I don't think it had any lasting beneficial impact, and we probably could have used that money more effectively elsewhere.
I got to agree with you 100%. Then, as we mentioned, just almost exactly a year ago, you were on this show. We had seen that increase in prices through April 2010, and again, we were declining, as you said, right around again that $80. Now, during that show, you described your indicators. We walked through them in detail. Talked about your lead indicators, the supply piece we talked a little bit about today, the demand picture, all of those things, and you made a prediction that the price decrease would soon end. But before I share that, because that's a great transition to where we are today, let me remind our radio audience that you're listening to the Wealth DNA radio show. I'm your host, Ron Naraki, and look forward to you joining us every second and fourth Monday. If you've missed some of the prior shows, like the one I just mentioned with Michael Orr in April of 2011, or you want to re-listen, we maintain an archive of shows on WealthDNA.us. So that's WealthDNA.us. And if you want to get an email reminder of radio shows, you can do one of two things. Either send me an email, ron@WealthDNA.us. I'll keep you posted about future shows. Or in the upper left-hand side of the screen, very upper left-hand corner, there's a little picture of the Bourne and the Bay. Right under there is a follow button. You can click that. And, of course, you can do both those things as well. As I mentioned, our guest today is Michael Orr. We're talking about when will housing prices rise. We just talked about the fact that he made a bold prediction in April of 2011. We're about to share that. Now, we've got lots of things to cover, but if you do happen to have some questions, there is a chat window below the radio player, and you can type in your comments, and we'll try to make sure that we fit it in or meld it into the questions I have. Okay, Michael, that brings us back to where we are today. You made a prediction in 2011 that based on those lead indicators, the pace of sales, inventories, etc., around October of 2011, we should see a bottom and prices would start ticking up. Now, can you modestly share with our audience how close you were?
Well, I was a little too pessimistic because the bottom was really August, September. It depends on which measure you're using. If you use price per square foot, it was September the 15th, to be very precise. If you use average prices, it was September the 5th. And if you use median prices, it was several days in August. So
August.
It was bumping on along for really through July, August, and September were all pretty bad. But by the time we got to October, things were starting to improve. And have been improving since that point, in fact.
Yeah, you were really pessimistic, and the pundits would say it was just a lucky guess, because they were predicting that we'd continue to see declines for another 5 or 10 years. So I would say congratulations on making predictions based on the real data and your indicators rather than guesswork or conjecture, or as you touched on, some people will make an estimate of the future and then look for the data to support it. Usually you can find some. So I think you did a great job, and
guess why
we have you back on here to keep telling us what's going to happen. So, and you know that's coming here. The Case-Shiller data, one of the other databases that covers the entire country, is one of those that not only uses different data, but more importantly, tends to look at year-over-year data, so it's much, and it's sent out much later. But in some of the most recent issues of their data, Arizona stood out a little bit. It was one of 50 states that was different. Tell us a little bit about what Case-Shiller has been saying about the market.
Yeah, well, Case-Shiller, as you say, is different. It measures a three-month average, which tends to smooth things out a bit. It also takes about 2 months for them to publish that data. So I usually have a pretty good idea of what it's going to look like for the following 2 or 3 months. And for the last 4 months, they don't measure at the state level. They measure at the major conurbation. So if we're talking about the greater Phoenix area, they've shown prices starting to inch upwards for the last 4 months. And when that first started happening, the first 2 months, we were the only city in the States where that was happening. And now, in the most recent report, I think a couple of other locations have started to move in that direction too. But it looks like Phoenix is leading the way in terms of prices improving, while some areas are still headed downwards.
Correct. And that's something that I think most people just are not aware of, that the Phoenix market really has been, you know, kind of leading that. Now, let me just ask you a question, just kind of, when, especially if you look at the year-over-year data and something like, any analysis. And if they're measuring, let's say, because of the lag, January 2011 through January 2012, wouldn't that kind of dramatically understate the increase, kind of like measuring the slopes of a bathtub by looking at the edges in terms of what they're going to be reporting?
Well, if you're measuring an annual average, obviously things will turn around very slowly. A quarterly average will be somewhat faster, and a monthly average will be much faster, but it'll also be quite volatile, so you might see it bump around rather than giving them a clearer indication. And the main index that Case-Shiller uses is based on a quarterly average.
It tends to be the main one. Okay.
Yeah, they do year-to-year comparisons, but the data they're measuring, for example, the data from March, which is the most recent, is from the months of November, December, and January. Mm-hmm. So, if you like, the midpoint would be December the 15th that we're talking about now. Very shortly, they should come out with their new index, and that will cover December, January, and February. So, each time they come out with a new number, a month is added, and the oldest month drops off. But we're still not talking about sales data from March or April, which is what I'm most interested in.
Sure.
And of course, as a recovery takes form and starts to accelerate, it's the most recent prices that are the most important to measure. They tell you whether the recovery is really starting to bite or whether it's fading.
Okay. Share with us, for the Phoenix market, what we've seen in terms of an increase since that August-September bottom. How much are we up?
Well, we actually dipped below the $82 a foot in August-September, down to around the $78 a mark when we touched bottom. The most latest measurement that I took yesterday is $94.48. So we're up quite a bit from that low. And in fact, the appreciation rate compared with comparing April 2012 with April 2011 is now up to 13%. So that's quite a significant upward trend, which those people buying houses can probably relate to, but those people not active in the market would probably be surprised by.
Absolutely, and that's why I wanted to share that. And if we did take just that from that bottom, August, September, I did the rough numbers, and annualized it, we'd be looking at about a 30% per year increase, which makes it look a little bit scary when it kind of reminds us of 2002-2003. But that's what I want to kind of switch to is where we're going, because that's where we are. We've seen an increase to the tune of an annualized 30%, or as you said, appropriately, year over year is about 13%. Still dramatic,
right?
But it's that recent trend that is almost scary. So, a year's been a long time. The markets change, since you were on the show last time, and markets change dramatically. So, if you look at your indicators now, does that upward trend we've seen recently is that likely to continue?
All the indicators are still looking very positive, and the primary reason for that is the shortage of supply. Which kind of contradicts what most people
think.
Most people have been hearing the phrase glut of foreclosed homes for sale for 4 years, and they assume that it's still true. And actually, if you go out there and try and buy a foreclosed home, you find there are not that many, and everyone is spoken for about 24 times over. So we've actually got a shortage of homes for sale, which is driving the prices upwards, as in any market, when you've got low supply and high demand. Prices rise until supply starts to improve. And at the moment, we're still in a position where supply is going down. So until supply starts coming up again, there's no reason to expect home prices to do anything but continue to increase.
Okay. Now, the you know, basic economics, as you would well know, and everybody listening, would be that the supply-demand picture. As prices go up, supply is going to come on. People are going to say, oh, at that price, I'm willing to sell. But if I look at those numbers, and you said $94 per square foot now, and I compare that to, let's say, somebody that bought their house in during that boom at $150, $170 or more per square foot, you know, is $94 or $100 a square foot enough to bring on that supply, or could we see a pretty dramatic move upward before that supply starts to come on board?
I don't think it's tempting to most people. I mean, there hasn't been much of a change. We've seen a little bit of increase in the rate of which new listings are coming on, but it's tiny and not going to have any significant effect yet. And I would expect, really, that we're going to have to get up beyond the 2000 level before many people get very excited about selling their homes. You know, if we're going to have to get above 100 and then some.
Correct.
And in fact, if you take a long-term view, you say, well, if we were at $100 a foot in 2000, then by now, based on long-term inflation rates, we probably should be around 120. And that's
probably
the point that I would say, that's a measurement point. Until we get to 120, we're still underpriced against the long-term trend. And it's probably only when we go above 120 that we'll see a significant number of people say, oh, now's a good time to list my house. Now I can get a decent price for it.
And if we're up to 120, that's probably about then that the media will start talking about it a little bit more, not just experts like yourself. So then more and more people will know about it. But at this point, they have to listen to this show or subscribe or attend some of the sessions you do to hear some of this news, because the news doesn't want to necessarily, the media doesn't want to necessarily report it.
Well, what I've found is that even if the media does report it, the public doesn't believe it when they report it, if it's different from what they heard last time. They actually have to hear it many times before it actually becomes well known and accepted wisdom. Otherwise, they just think, oh, it's some freak reporting something that doesn't fit with my preconceived idea.
Correct. And I remember the question on CNN was just absolutely absurd. The person that was interviewing you had asked you some questions about the uptick, and you shared some information. And then the one that was, you know, back to the anchor or whatever, they said, now, was that up by, 1% over, the peak, or is that 1% over the prior year? I mean, it's kind of like, over the peak, where she had been. It's like no tune to the housing market. Very, very funny. Now, one of the things I'm watching pretty carefully, and it's a little bit too early to tell if my predictions are right, but it could be that more people stay in their homes, and it could be either because of HARP 2.0, or and HARPA 2.0 would allow them to refinance and at least lower their monthly prices, or that they start to see some price increases and start to say, well, wait a minute, let me see how this all shakes out before I leave now. I might be leaving at the wrong time. And additionally, we're in an election year, and the current administration could do something even more rash and try to pump up the economy and curtail they're going to pump up the economy. They're not going to curtail spending. They're going to continue spending. So, you know, could it be that this supply picture actually gets complicated more because fewer people want to foreclose?
Well, I think HARP 2.0 is going to keep more people in their homes because being able to get a lower interest rate makes it more tolerable to be underwater. So I think 2011 was probably the peak year for short selling. There's still some incentives because of the current situation where the taxable forgiveness of debt is possibly going to expire this year, and some people are saying, well, maybe if they're going to do a short sale, they should do it now rather than take the risk of being taxed on the shortfall next year. But nobody knows for sure whether that tax rule would be extended. And on the whole, I see a slightly lower tendency for people to want to short sale because at least they can get some relief on their payments with HARP 2.0. And if the market is moving up, then then the amount by which that underwater is going down. So they feel the situation at least is improving and not getting worse.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea what might be done on a political basis, and I don't like to speculate. I wait to see what happens and then measure it. So I'm not sure that we're going to see any significant effects from the election at the moment. I'm just waiting to see, and we'll report as it happens.
Well, hopefully if they debate some dumb idea, they call you in and ask you your views on the effects of the market before they implement something. That would be helpful.
Well, I do think that we sometimes underestimate the value of the systems that are in place and try to fiddle with them. In Nevada right now, they've put us, much more severe restrictions on banks in terms of having them to document a lot more before they can foreclose. But that it's not necessarily good for the market, because people who are delinquent just take an awful lot longer to get foreclosed, which really just delays the resolution of the problem. And getting people who are not paying their mortgage to actually complete a short sale or a foreclosure gets rid of the debt, gets the home into a safe pair of hands, and from the point of view of everybody apart from that homeowner, gets the market into a healthier situation. And I think, to Arizona's credit, we've had a very efficient and effective foreclosure process, which is unpleasant for the people being foreclosed, but it's actually good news for the market, because we get through more of the debt problems faster than most other states. In fact, probably over the last 2 years, we've handled the foreclosure problem faster than any state, which is why our housing economy is starting to improve, because we've now got through most of the problems and the delinquency rate is down much closer to normal.
Excellent point. I forget about that difference between the deed of trust and the mortgage states, but just because I'm here, I kind of assume everybody's doing the same. But you're absolutely correct, and a very good point. I've got to kind of add to my bag of tools when I think through these situations. Now, let me take the economist's favorite expression. On the other hand, because we talked about some positives, like HARP 2.0, and it is an election year, and prices are ticking up, there might not be much supply, et cetera. Those are all positive. But during the summer, housing prices, once we get through this peak buying season through about June or so, housing demand drops off a little bit. So given those two sides of the equation, where do you expect to see Phoenix area housing prices, let's say, 6 months from now or a year from now?
Well, you're absolutely right. The demand does drop a little bit during the summer and then really fades through the rest of the year and doesn't really pick up again until February. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's going to reverse the pricing trend. It's just going to take a little bit of the wind out of the sails. So the month-to-month increase is going to be at not quite the hectic pace that it was in, say, March, which was it was not just driven by the fact that the prices were going up. It was driven by the fact that distressed sales were disappearing very fast from the market, and normal sales were coming along. So the sales we were measuring were at a higher price per square foot, and those two things fed on each other to give us a change during the month, which is almost unheard of, February to March, of about 7%, and I don't think that's sustainable. Something like somewhere between 2 and 5% per month is probably the most you could expect in terms of a short term price change. And I would think over the rest of this year we're going to be seeing more reasonable and gradual increases. I can't currently see any reason why we would see any price declines, even if we did have a significant fall in demand, because supply is still at an unusually low level. Mm-hmm. The only areas where there's some reasonable amount of supply are in the luxury market and in the active adult 55-plus communities, where there's still plenty of homes for sale. So the general market is likely to continue to increase in price for at least 6 months and possibly as long as a year, although I hesitate to look that far out because there are so many unknowns that could affect the overall economy in that time.
Yeah, but 2%, even the low end of that 2% per month is pretty darn dramatic if you look at the long-term
yes.
trends. But again, compared to where we are at the bottom of the bathtub or where we were at the bottom of the bathtub, it could get us out pretty quickly, and we could be at that 120 a year from now.
Yeah, we have such an extreme shortage that prices are going to continue to go up at a significant pace, and 2% per month, as you say, is very significant.
Yep.
Until they go up enough to bring a lot more supply into the market, which then rebalances things and we get back to a more normal situation. And none
okay.
of us know
no,
exactly when that will happen.
No, I definitely like your indicator of like that 120, and I think that's a fair point where more people will start getting interest. And now they may might bring their house on the market at 130 or 140, but at least the supply will start showing up.
Yes.
But again, I guess that's part of the process. Now, let me ask you the question. I'm sure you expect it, because I think you get it at every single presentation I've ever attended or I'm aware of. How about that huge shadow inventory of the millions of homes that banks are going to dump on the market as soon as prices rise?
Well, this really puzzles me, because I have a spreadsheet containing all of the homes that the banks own in the Greater Phoenix market. It's not
right.
It's not really in the shadows. It's a matter of public record. When a bank gets to own a home, they do it through foreclosure or through a deed in lieu of foreclosure. And either way, there's a public record, which means you can track it.
Mm-hmm.
And that people talk about millions of homes, but I don't count the millions. I count probably about 7,000 for the Greater Phoenix that are in the bank's hands but not actually listed, and that's just the sort of just the normal
time to get it on the market. Sure,
time to get it on the market. So they're not hiding them, they're not delaying things. The idea that the banks have got this hidden inventory is just ludicrous in my mind. The only thing that makes sense in terms of the banks manipulating market is not with homes they already own, but they would maybe delay foreclosures, allow mm-hmm. people to stay in homes and be delinquent for longer while they if they've got all they can handle.
Mm-hmm.
But we're seeing
right.
that head downwards too. I don't track that on a daily basis because I don't have detailed loan information available. But if
right.
I look at
sure.
the people who do, you know, the mortgage bankers associations,
mm-hmm.
the lender processing services, CoreLogic, these people track that sort of thing. And the thing to watch is, what's the delinquency rate doing? People who are late but not in foreclosure, is that going up or down? And for some states, it's still going up, but for Arizona, it's been going down quite sharply, from reaching a peak at over 12% of loans at the beginning in the first quarter of 2010 to about 6.6% now. So that's headed in the right direction. Normal is about 4.5%, so we're only about 2% above the normal situation. So I don't regard that as any more a threatening inventory. I mean, it certainly was back in December 2010,
sure.
but really it has been handled with all the short sales and foreclosures and brought down to a manageable level.
Yeah,
so
I'm
not expecting that to solve our supply problem anytime.
No,
not anytime soon.
Exactly. It's important for people to hear that from you. I mean, it scares me how many times I hear from somebody that asks me, hey, I got an opinion from my realtor that there's millions of houses still coming to shadow inventory, and maybe I should just keep waiting.
There's some truth in other states, particularly those with a judicial foreclosure process.
Right, right.
Where you've got a lot of delinquent situations which are not getting resolved, and at the current rate will take years to come out. So
sure.
the concept of a shadow inventory is valid if you're looking at that sort of situation, but it's not valid when it's applied to Arizona.
Right, and that's court delay. It's not necessarily a conscious effort, or some bank executive is manipulating the market here.
Well, certainly, if you look at states like Florida, they've got an enormous percentage of their loans are actually in foreclosure but stuck in litigation and
correct.
Not coming out the
correct.
Other end.
Exactly. Okay, before we jump to our final segment, let me just let our listeners know, if you just tuned in, you're listening to the Wealth DNA radio show. I'm your host, Ron Naraki. If you missed the earlier part of this show, it will be on the archive, and you can find that archive on wealthdna.us. Today we have Michael Orr as our guest, the guy that knows more about the Phoenix housing market than anyone else on the planet. Michael, feel free to quote me on that.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's talk about the contrast to the broader U.S. housing market. Now, based on what the demographic experts are telling us, they're saying the next generation is less likely to become homeowners in the past, that this whole foreclosure thing, this tendency to want to rent and be more freewheeling, a whole number of trends would say that there are going to be fewer homeowners. Now, on the surface, that's telling people that home prices will rise less quickly. Give us your view on that macro trend.
Well, I think there's some truth to the demographic things about differences between generations. On the other hand, we've got a shadow demand building up in that lots of families have doubled up in order to cope with the bad economy over the last few years. We've got kids staying with their parents much longer than they used to, rather than going out and finding a home. And we've also got a situation where renting makes less financial sense than buying for the vast majority of people in a location like Phoenix, where purchase prices have become very low, but rents have not actually changed very much. If anything, they've gone up over the last few years, particularly the multifamily. The rents have actually increased in the last couple of years. So I think that's likely to counter any generational trend. And given that we've built very few houses for now, nearly 5 years of very low construction.
That's true.
We've had population increase over that time. So we've now got a situation where demand for housing exceeds the supply, contrary to what most people think. And the builders are going to have to get busy over the next few years to cope with not just that shadow demand, but new incoming population that moves to Arizona. You know, we've always attracted a lot of people, typically 150,000 a year during the heyday. I think we haven't been at that rate for the last 4 years, but we'll probably get back there sometime over the next 5 years. And construction will become an important part of the market again.
Mm-hmm. And to some extent, we've seen some of this already happening over the last 3 years. I mean, basically, very few owner-occupants have been able to buy homes for qualification, or they lost a house or whatever else. And what's happened is housing providers, or again, often called real estate investors, have been doing a lot of the buying, fixing, and renting of those homes, and that is still a purchase, and it still will create a demand, even if people are renting. So to me,
absolutely,
it sounds like we're on the, you know, it doesn't change the picture that people still want to live somewhere.
Yeah, the number of people buying homes from investors who bought a foreclosure or a short sale and fixed them up, improved them, that's very significant now. It was very significant last year, actually much more significant than the home construction in terms of keeping trades employed. And those are transactions that count in all my numbers, and it's been a significant part. It probably will continue to be a significant part of the housing business in Phoenix.
Yeah, and it's nice to see that you're able to now split that out even in terms of how many were investor to buyer.
Yeah, that's one of the things I added to the ASU report that comes out each month, is separating out the normal transactions from the investor flips to see where those are happening most frequently and at what prices.
That's great. That is great. That is very, very helpful, because otherwise we were conjecturing. Now, I know the Cromford Report is, and I not only know, but it's unfortunate that it's not available in other markets yet. But you look at other areas of the country. What other areas are likely to join Phoenix in this uptrend in the near future?
Well, I only take a cursory look at other areas,
sure,
because I'm so busy covering the Phoenix area. But I think what you need to look out for is two main things in other areas. Is the delinquency rate coming down, and what's happening to the number of listings measured on the supply. So if you look at Nevada, for example, a state which is quite similar to us in terms of its history for real estate, they now have a very short supply of listings, so they're starting to see the same sort of cycle where people who are trying to buy a house have very little to choose from, and they get multiple bids. So that's very positive for Nevada. What's not quite so positive is, although their delinquency rate has come down, it's still much higher than Arizona, and so they're not as far through the resolution of the foreclosure wave as we are. But they're following in a similar trend. And generally, I think those states that have a deed of trust rather than judicial foreclosure are going to be coming out of their the problematic housing market faster. And if you look at the active listing count and measure the months of inventory, that will give you a clue as to which ones are going to join us in terms of recovery over the next year or two.
Okay.
And we won't be alone for long. I think if you look at the Case-Shiller index over the next few months, you'll see several cities start to move upwards in price. Not all of them, of course. There are some areas which still have a lot of problems to resolve.
Absolutely. Any that you would mention that are not likely to recover? I mean, I always think of areas like Detroit or Ohio that are very hard hit in the industrial arena. Are those likely to recover in anywhere in the near future?
Detroit is a special case because their prices have come down enormously, and it's hard to think that they will actually suffer much more. I think there's a certain amount of recovery going on there. So they're one of the places that I actually feel more optimistic about because they've already taken it on the chin and are in recovery. I think the Washington area has always had a shortage because there's so many jobs there and it's expanding. And the prices have stayed relatively high, unlike Detroit. They've lost less, but that's a healthy market, the Northern Virginia and Baltimore, Washington area. There are several places that are looking like they're shaping up for recovery. There's one or two that are puzzling me because they still don't look like they have been turning around. Atlanta has had a pretty bad period, for example, for the last 6 months, come down in pricing quite a bit, which is surprising because they never had really anything like the significant bubble that we had. But I'm not an expert on these other areas, so I can't tell if there's local reasons for that.
Now, it could just happen that one of our listeners, and I apologize, I'm keeping you a little bit longer. I've already signaled our producer that we may run a little bit extra, and we're okay still time-wise from his standpoint. It could be that one of our listeners would just be an ideal partner in some other part of the country to start the Cromford, help you start the Cromford Report in other places, and I know there's a demand for it. What kind of person would be ideal for that role? If you were looking for somebody to start it in Atlanta or Detroit or anywhere else, what would that partner look like?
Well, I guess they need to be interested in three things. One of them would be obviously real estate.
Sure.
Another one would be mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
And another one would be computers. And I happen to be, somebody who's played around and worked with and enjoys working with three of those. Anybody who really likes all three of those things and would really enjoy combining them would be an ideal candidate. So I guess that's a real estate nerd is what we're talking about. And somebody who actually enjoys numbers and graphs rather than being scared off by them.
Okay. Yeah, and unfortunately, I live in the Phoenix market, so I'm not available to do that in the other markets. It sounds like something I would enjoy doing. Now, one last point. Because it really does look, you've done a great job. And, of course, you've built a lot of the tools already, so it's not like they have to reinvent the wheel completely. It's getting the local market under control and applying the tools.
The data is key.
Exactly.
People underestimate that. They kind of take data for granted and think that the tools are the important thing, but the quality of the data that's important.
Absolutely.
So, being able to get hold of it, obviously MLSs have proprietary data, so you've got to come in, get a good working relationship, a trusting relationship with the MLS.
Right.
And use public records too. Public records are not always easily available. Some counties actually charge you a lot of money for accessing the records. Other counties give it away for free. So you need to know the local situation to be able to do the same sort of thing as I've done in other areas and work with that local situation to collect the information.
No, that's a key point. I would assume that person has to be in that market. There's almost no other way to do it. Okay,
yeah, local knowledge is very important.
All right, one last point I want to share, and if you want to comment on it, I'd appreciate that. But inflation has been pretty low, and everybody's talked about how low it is officially, and yet it seems much higher because food and energy tends to get ignored, and of course none of us eat or consume energy on a daily basis, so we can ignore those. But in the last 5 years, housing, both rentals and during that whole 5 years, maybe recently not, but rental prices, mortgage rates, housing prices have come down. So CPI has been low and, if you will, helped by or kept down by housing. And yet, housing is the single largest component, between 34 and 42%, depending on which of the CPI measures. If housing prices stop declining, as we've seen in Phoenix, or they even start rising nationally, like we've, of course, seen very dramatically here in Phoenix, could that mean that inflation could be stepping up fairly rapidly, in which case people will start to panic and want to buy real estate because it's a tangible asset and you don't want to be hanging out in cash when inflation is rising?
That's certainly all plausible. I'm not very familiar with how the housing figures get integrated into the CPI, but obviously it's probably going to be a combination of rent and purchase prices and mortgage rates and all these other things. And of course, what anybody is buying a house for this year does not necessarily affect you if you're not buying a house. You know, if you bought a house several years ago and locked in a rate on a 30-year mortgage, you've got a pretty fixed payment for a long time, which is also a nice hedge against inflation because you know your payment is going to stay the same even though inflation is driving the value of the dollar down. So, generally speaking, if you don't own a house, then you're probably going to be thinking, well, if inflation is taking off, then real estate starts to look much more attractive as a protection against inflation.
Exactly.
Because over the long term, real estate has generally performed as well as inflation and sometimes better. And so your dollars actually grow if they're in real estate instead of falling behind if you've got them in some sort of liquid asset like a savings account. So, you know, there's an awful lot of speculation there, but generally the trend suggests that inflation is more likely to increase than go down from this very low level we've seen in recent years. And if so, then all forms of real estate, not just housing, but then commercial real estate, their land, et cetera, are going to start to look more popular.
Exactly.
We're in a cyclical market. Yeah,
exactly.
We're in a cyclical market, and you know, the cycle always comes around. It's been extremely unpopular for several years, so real estate is overdue for starting to get more popular.
Exactly. Okay, Michael, we've covered about 2 hours worth of topics, and I apologize for taking a little extra of your time, but really appreciate your being on. Now, are there some topics that we may have overlooked that we should still cover before we summarize here?
Well, the only thing that I'm thinking about these days that concerns me, well, not the only one, but really the most important one, is we're going to start to see a demand for new homes come back over this year.
Right.
And that raises the issue as who's going to build them, because probably 90% of the people in construction have disappeared as we went from 42,000 homes a year down to 5,000 homes a year being built in the area. So I think we're going to have to do, you know, as a state, some soul searching as when we start building up construction, where are those roofers and drywallers going to come from?
Mm-hmm.
And given, as we all know, those used to be supplied very heavily from undocumented workers.
Correct.
We're either going to create demand for that to happen from the same source, or we're going to have to find another source from domestic workers. But the issue is we just don't have them at the moment, so we're going to have some major training programs or some sort of mechanisms to meet that need, which we really haven't thought through fully yet.
Interesting point. Interesting. And I always worry about the opposite, that new home builders start to build too soon and depress the rebuilding of housing prices, or basically the restart of that uptick.
I don't think they can.
They could if they
had an unlimited labor supply, but you can't just take anybody off the street and make them a skilled construction worker. And builders use subcontractors. They don't do many of those trades themselves. And those subcontractors have got only a small number of teams, and they have no obvious way of growing that labor force because the people who used to be available are not around anymore.
Excellent point. I really appreciate that comment, and quite frankly, even those subcontractors are pretty busy because we use them, and they're not always
available.
They're
very busy right now. I think they're maxed out, and that's the issue that the home builders are saying, well, we'd like to, maybe we could double our production rate for the second half of this year. Can you provide me with, and the contractors are saying no.
No.
And of course, that's
going to
push pricing up too. You know, price of labor We've already got price of materials fairly high, but the price of labor could also go up, and new home prices are almost certainly going to rise over the next couple of years.
Well, that's actually even more encouraging news, and people heard it here first. Michael, thank you for joining us, and I sure hope you'll join us again, and maybe we'll make April an annual tradition. What do you think?
Yeah, that sounds like a good idea.
Okay, let me summarize for our listeners. You've heard some things here maybe for the first time that the market prices are starting to head up fairly dramatically. We've covered a lot of information on the Phoenix housing market, and hopefully you feel like you got your money's worth. Maybe we should offer double money-back guarantee. What do you think? One of the things I didn't interject I should have is we use some terminology like MLS. Make sure everybody knows that's the multiple listing service. And Michael used the term armless, and that is the Arizona Regional Multiple Listing Service. It is not a physical handicap. So first time I heard that phrase, I had to kind of stop and think what they meant. But ARMLS, which is Arizona Regional MLS. Now, for the listeners in the other parts of the U.S. or other parts of the world, this might seem like Phoenix is just plain different. How, you know, prices are going up there, but they sure aren't elsewhere. Well, I'm pretty sure even listeners in Phoenix were surprised by a lot of the information they heard today. So they may be changing. You're just not aware of it. It takes an expert like Michael to notice it. And the housing market's been changing very rapidly. And as I said, in the last 12 months since Michael was on this show last, we sure have seen a lot of change from the prices going down to bottoming and heading up very dramatically. Now, on our last show, we talked about investing in rental properties, and today you know a lot more about whether it may be a good time to get started. In my opinion, there's never been a better time. Incidentally, in the next few shows, we'll cover a range of ways investing in real estate, and from my perspective, it will be, of course, from my perspective or my specialty, which is residential real estate. Now, what most listeners might not know is that Michael Orr and I have an unusual thing in common. We both had fires in our offices in the last few years, which impacted our businesses. So if you subscribe to the Crawford Report, you might notice there's a 2 or 3 month period where some of the data is just plain missing. He tried to keep everything up to date, but there are some months that just could not get everything in there. So that's why. Another thing you may not be aware of is that in 2000 to 2006, those boom years, really from 2002, I should say, through 2006, I didn't own any properties in the U.S., didn't even live in the U.S., so I often joke that you can't blame me for what happened. I even hear stories about people standing in line, and I missed all of that. Would have been fun to see. But who knows? We may see it happen again. Let me summarize a couple of the other key facts that we talked about today. First of all, most importantly, if you do want to subscribe or work with a realtor to subscribe to the Crawford Report, it is www.crawfordreport.com, C-R-O-M-F-O-R-D. And second point was that prices tend to rise steadily year after year, housing prices. They've never moved huge amounts up until recently, and there is a chance that when they do start rising real dramatically, they may just drop dramatically soon afterwards, as they did. And Phoenix and most other markets in the U.S. have seen a lost decade when it comes to housing prices. We often talk about the S&P 500 was virtually flat for a number of 10-year periods, not just one 10-year period. Well, housing was down 20% from 2001 and 2009 and really continued that pace, so really 2001 through 2012. Now, you may have noticed S&P is up about 100% since 2009 bottom, and it's now nearing its peak. If the experts you hear on this show and my inflation analysis are correct, the trends in the housing market might just continue as they have, and we might just see 100% increase in housing prices, or maybe even more. Incidentally, it is possible to make money in real estate even when prices are declining, like 2007 to 2012. I should know. The real estate fund I run made money every one of those years. Although I'll admit, I'm looking forward to the next few years when they're heading up. And the fourth point we talked about is the housing market experienced a double dip with the first bottom in 2009, the second in the late summer of 2011. Had the government not intervened, it would have been a little bit different and maybe a steady growth instead of a double dip. Fifth is Phoenix was one of the hardest hit markets, and it is a growth-oriented market, so it appears to be recovering first. There are other markets that will follow. And the recovery, as we talked about, has been pretty dramatic. Will it continue? Well, if anyone knows, Michael Orr does, and you heard his comments right here. Lastly, will the housing market be negatively impacted by the next generation losing faith in home ownership as a component of living the American dream? Again, you heard Michael's comments, and in my case, I'm positioning our real estate fund to take advantage of either home sales or rentals, whatever our clients prefer. So, is investing in real estate a good idea? I can't answer that for you, but we will be providing a lot of information on that topic in the next few shows, so join us. And of course, it's a great way to improve your prospects for becoming wealthy. Tune into the show every 2 weeks. We'll challenge you, share good ideas, introduce you to some great guests, and inspire you to be as wealthy as you want to be. If you haven't been receiving emails about the show, or if you have some suggestions for topics or guests, send an email to ron@wealthdna.us, or just call me. The next Wealth DNA radio show is the second Monday of May. We'll be continuing the discussion on investing in rental properties. That's Monday, May 14th, 8 o'clock Arizona time. Same place, same time. And remember, the link for that show, as well as the archives of past shows and this one today, are available on www.wealthdna.us. FYI, the next Boomer and Babe show coming up at 10 a.m. is with Susan Braverman. She's a life coach. Help you enjoy all the wealth we'll help you accumulate. Happy investing and enjoy watching your home appreciate in value again.
You've been listening to Wealth DNA with the Ronald, Ron Naraki. Wealth DNA is a Boomer and the Babe Enterprises radio production. Contact them at boomerandthebabe.com.